This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Today brought two major decisions from the Supreme Court, and we're going to dive into both, starting with Trump v. Hawaii, better known as the case of President Trump's travel ban. The court upheld the ban in a familiar 5-4 vote, but with some strong dissents and one very peculiar concurrence. President Trump took a quick victory lap, calling the court's decision a win for the American people.
Today's Supreme Court ruling, just coming out, a tremendous success, a tremendous victory for the American people and for our Constitution.
For more on how the court reached its decision and what it means going forward, we turn to Kari Hong, Boston College law professor. Kari, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
First of all, we should note for the record that you filed an amicus brief in the first iteration of this legal challenge.
Yes.
Well, that being said, you've had a couple of hours at least to read through today's decision. Give us a quick summary. What was the case about? What did the court say?
Yes. And as a quick clarification, the first travel ban where the airport was filled with the lawyers and the chaos, that travel ban was the first travel ban that is not at issue. That died a death in the Ninth Circuit and was not revived. This case was a more limited one. It did not apply to anyone with a green card, and it did not apply to anyone who either had a family, work, or tourist visa that had been issued before September 2017. The question was, going forward, are people from 5 Muslim-majority countries and 2 other countries, can the president bar them from receiving visas to come to the United States? And the majority decision said yes. They said as a matter of statutory interpretation, looking at the section, which is 212F, that the text says the president can suspend the entry of any alien if it's detrimental to the country. And the court said that says what it means. That means what it says. And so that was a pretty clear standard statutory interpretation that was done at that level.
So I'll confess, I also read it. Some parts of the decision seem weirdly divorced from reality. And here, for instance, is the court's summary of events. So I'm just quoting here. President Trump first ordered DHS and other agencies to conduct a comprehensive evaluation of every country's compliance. He then issued a proclamation with extensive findings about the deficiencies. Based on that review, he found that restricting entry of aliens who could not be vetted with adequate information was in the national interest. They make it sound like this very deliberate process. That's not my recollection. I covered this for the Globe. I don't recall it being such a deliberate process.
Well, no, and I think that's what was really interesting about the second takeaway, where Justice Roberts and the majority said, look, if the president said that this is because of national security, that is true, that we will not look behind that. We will not be fact-checking the president. And they said, yes, our prior cases so that we can fact-check other government officials, but we are not going to fact-check the president.
And the president does say it's necessary for national security. Here he is earlier today.
We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
Well, just because the president was happy with the decision doesn't mean everyone was happy, not even everyone on the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor penned a pretty pointed dissent, emphasizing this policy came out of a clear campaign promise to crack down on Muslim immigration. Here's Trump at a campaign rally in December 2015.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Kari, what did you make of the dissent?
Well, I think the difference between the two is the majority said, he says it's national security, he's the president, that's enough for us. The dissent said, wait a minute, this is about religious discrimination. And we all know that to be the case. And that is what we need to look at as a court and as a country. What's also very interesting is that the majority went out of its way to overturn the Korematsu case, which is the case that upheld the Japanese internment camps on the basis of national security. And Justice Roberts said that was immoral then, it's immoral now. Sotomayor says, look, we have been here before. We have heard the government say national security is enough. We don't need to look behind it. And yes, it's nice that today we're finally overturning that precedent, but the ghost lives on. And so that was her concern, very, very pointed in that respect.
And yet a dissent is a dissent. It's a statement into the void. It doesn't win the day.
Well, I wouldn't say it goes into the void. I mean, the question is usually most justices play the long game where they hope that their dissents become the majority someday. So it is for history, it is for other people, but it doesn't go into the void.
Can we talk about Justice Kennedy's concurrence? Because in addition to the majority decision, Justice Kennedy penned this like 2-page statement. Can you fill us in on this?
Three paragraphs. So it was very short, which is very interesting. And what he basically said, I mean, the way that I read it is as if a parent told a teenager, just to let you know, I'm leaving the house. I expect you not to take out the car, but the keys are on the table. And in that respect, what Kennedy said is that just because the Supreme Court cannot review and will not correct any constitutional or unconstitutional actions, we expect that the federal officers who are charged with administering the Constitution will do the right thing and follow the law and follow the Constitution. But he did give the teenager the keys and left the room.
And I mean, it's so strange, I think, as a position to be saying this is not reviewable, and yet I have constitutional or constitutionally grounded concerns about it. Is this a common position to the justices take?
Well, it's a longstanding debate about what is the role of the courts. And so in that context, that happens a lot, where many times federal judges will say, look, we're not happy about this, but we can't reach that decision. Or we're not happy with this, but we don't have to resolve that issue because it's resolved on a more narrow ground. So that's a common discourse that judges and justices do engage in. What was notable that when any time I think a Supreme Court justice says something they don't have to say, that is an important thing to pay attention
right,
to.
Right. Nobody forced him to write this concurrence.
Correct. And it is 3 paragraphs.
Yeah. Now, does this ruling change much on the ground? The travel ban had been in force for some time, correct?
Yes. The Supreme Court lifted the stay. So as a practical matter, it does not change anything on a day-to-day. That said, there are families that are being divided because of this. So for the people who are impacted, that those impacts will be in the foreseeable future continuing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand, Kari. Kari Hong is law professor at Boston College. For more on local reaction to the Supreme Court holding, we're joined by WBR reporter Fred Tice. How are you doing, Fred?
Good, good, Evan. How are you?
It's great to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
So what are you hearing from the refugee community here in New England?
General disappointment. I spoke to leaders of refugee organizations, and of course, they're quite disappointed. But perhaps more pointedly, I was able to speak to one of these families that are now going to be separated indefinitely. I spoke to a man named Yusuf Abdi. He was born in Mogadishu in Somalia. He's an American citizen now, working in Lowell, and he's been trying to bring his mother and his siblings to the United States. They live in Uganda. And he found out recently that they had been put on a list of people to be assassinated should they ever be returned to Somalia. Their dad was a general in the army there, was assassinated before their eyes, he says. And so he's been working hard to get his mom and the rest of the family to the United States.
She left Mogadishu, going through villages until she went to Ethiopia, running from the ones who assassinated her husband to save her kids. It's taking your kids through a river which is infested with a lot of crocodile. She went through all this and still keeping herself strong.
Yeah, imagine a river, going through a river
crocodiles?
Filled with crocodiles with your kids, right? He's now heartbroken because his mom's stuck in Uganda.
It's totally break us into pieces. Very disappointing family. We are working so hard to make sure that we could live the life everybody deserved.
So clearly very upset.
Yeah, I mean, fled war, crocodiles. I mean, How is the refugee community at large going to be affected by today's Supreme Court?
So I spoke to Yusuf's boss, Jeff Thielman, and Jeff Thielman is the president and CEO of an organization called the International Institute of New England. They have helped resettle about 15,000 refugees in New England over the last 20 years or so. Thielman says this decision gives the president's administration essentially the right to discriminate.
The court clearly ignored anti-Muslim rhetoric by President Trump and many members of his administration and some members of the United States Congress. I think this decision gives license for more hatred in this country, for more anti-Muslim rhetoric, for more anti-refugee rhetoric.
And, you know, Thielman says that this sends the message that the way that President Trump talks about refugees and immigrants is okay.
Now, it should be clear, some people, presumably, right, some people are happy with the ruling because they support the president, they support the need for national security. You're drawing attention to some people who are going to be affected, negatively affected.
Indeed.
I understand that universities are also concerned.
They are. They are. Now, I just spoke this afternoon to Ken Reed. He is the director of the International Student and Scholar Services Office at UMass Amherst. Now, students are generally not affected, nor are scholars. They got visas, and they can come over here. But nevertheless, these folks are all quite worried. We're generally talking about Iranians in Massachusetts. There are loads of Iranian students in the United States, not many from the other Muslim countries concerned. They come here largely in electrical engineering. And he says the students are worried because, there's a reaction to the word ban.
It just escalates everybody's apprehension, and not just people from the countries that are directly affected by the ban, but literally people from all different countries, because again, they're wondering, is my country going to be next? And one of the hardest questions that we have when we're asked that question is we don't know.
Now, numbers of international students in Massachusetts are still very high, unlike other parts of the country. Reed was saying that a lot of the students and the scholars, now, legally they can leave the country and come back, you know, go to weddings and whatnot, see their parents. They don't do that anymore. They pretty much stay put. They're just too afraid to leave the country and facing the Customs and Border Protection when they come back.
Well, that's Fred Tice, WBR reporter. Thank you so much for joining us and
glad
to understand.
Yeah, glad to do it, Evan.
We turn now to the other Supreme Court decision released today, a case that involved pregnancy centers in California. For more on that case, we're joined by Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University. Professor Moreland, great to have you on Radio Boston.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Evan.
So before we get to the ruling, right, we're talking about a new case. Let's start from scratch again. What was this case all about?
So this is about a California statute called the Reproductive Freedom, Accountability, Comprehensive Care, and Transparency Act, or the FACT Act for short, that imposed a set of requirements on crisis pregnancy centers, that is to say, places that are pro-life and offer alternatives to abortion for pregnant women. And it required those crisis pregnancy centers to advertise the availability of abortion services in the state, and in a different context, different kinds of centers also to disclose the fact that they are not medically licensed centers, and the court today struck down that California statute.
So the state law had put in place certain requirements for what these crisis pregnancy centers had to say, and the court said, no, you can't force them to make such statements. Roughly like that?
Right. And it's important. There are two different requirements. One was for centers that were licensed to perform medical procedures, so ultrasounds, pregnancy tests, things like that. And those centers were the ones that had to disclose where women could obtain free or low-cost abortions. And then unlicensed centers, that is to say those that offered just counseling or diapers or other kinds of financial support, they had to disclose the fact that they were not medically licensed, that they didn't offer any medical services in prominent advertising. And as to both of those requirements, the court said that, in effect, California was requiring these centers to engage in, as it says, government-scripted disclosures about abortion, and that was a problem under the First Amendment.
So the goal, presumably, was to make sure consumers of medical care, people who are pregnant and looking for necessary aid, medical aid, aren't being misled. But the Supreme Court is saying, no, there are limits on what you can do, what you can force these senators to do. What's your read on the decision? It makes sense. It overreaches. What's your take?
Right. That's what the defenders of these laws, and I should say there have been a number of these laws across the country in different states and local governments, and for the most part they've been struck down, but the exception was in California where the lower courts had upheld it. And right, the defenders of these laws say that these disclosures are required in order to ensure that women aren't misled or aren't subject to fraud at a very vulnerable time. But again, the court said that California hadn't shown that it needed to impose this kind of a broad requirement in order to combat that potential problem of potentially misleading information. And I do agree the majority has it right here. I do think that California has other means at its disposal, as do other states, to address this kind of issue without forcing these centers to, in essence, advertise a service to which they have moral objections.
Now, there seems to me there's a more skeptical way to read the ruling, which is that it's actually an abortion case masquerading as a First Amendment case. For instance, here's Rebecca Hart Holder, the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts. She says she was shocked by today's ruling.
I think that all women who are considering abortion care should be given accurate, fact-based information about whether they want to get abortion care and how to safely obtain that care. And frankly, the fact that the Supreme Court would sanction lying and deceiving women at fake women's health centers is really shocking.
But Professor Moreland, you think on First Amendment grounds that's really where the case should have been decided?
I think it was primarily a free speech case, obviously, in the context of abortion. But the majority opinion, and the dissent as well, I should say, really are wrangling over free speech questions. That is to say, what's the level of deference that a court should give to the government with regard to its ability to regulate speech in different kinds of contexts? And the dissent by Justice Breyer makes a lot of the point that the states should have more leeway with regard to health and safety to require certain disclosures on the parts of medical professionals and other kinds of professionals. But the majority, I think, has a strong argument in response to that this California statute is far too broad and imposes far too great a requirement on these clinics in order to accomplish a much more narrower government interest, which is the interest in combating misleading information. If that were shown on the record, if there were such misleading information that was being pushed by these clinics, that would be another issue. But California didn't have anything like that in the record, and therefore I think it ran into some very serious First Amendment problems.
So yeah, as an example of the kind of thing that the dissenters are worried about. I mean, they bring up the other examples, like when people leave the hospital with a newborn child, there are restrictions in some states or laws in some states saying that doctors have to inform them about seatbelt laws or, you know, having safe child seats, child restraints, and that maybe that's the kind of thing that could also be considered compulsory speech.
Right, and that's a concern that the dissent raises, is that this approach the court adopts in the majority of any content, as we say in the law, it's a technical term, any content-based restriction on speech triggers this high level of scrutiny under the First Amendment. The dissent is very concerned that it will sweep in a lot of other kinds of government-required disclosures with regard to, you know, seatbelt laws or calorie counts or things like that. The majority's response to that is that, well, in the context of particular medical procedures where you have, say, requirements of what has to be disclosed to a patient as part of ensuring that the patient has given informed consent to a procedure, there the state has an ability to, through its licensing of medical professionals, to regulate their speech. But again, in this context, the requirement was far broader than that, and in fact, it exempted a lot of clinics from the requirement in such a way that it, as Justice Kennedy pointed out in a separate concurrence for himself and three other justices, there was even a concern here that these clinics were especially targeted for their viewpoint, and then that again is a very serious First Amendment problem.
So there's another issue that the dissenters bring up that I want to get your take on, which is that in a related case, the Supreme Court seemed upheld a law saying that states could lawfully require doctors to tell women who were seeking abortions about adoption options. Why doesn't it apply the other way, where women who are seeking pregnancy care doctors can be required to tell them about abortion?
Well, again, that goes back to whether or not one finds tenable the distinction that the majority opinion draws between what the government requires as part of informed consent in a medical procedure and more general requirements here of centers that may not perform medical procedures at all in some instances. And so, again, it's how tight the connection is between the government regulation and a medical procedure or whether it's looser than that. But you're right, that was a point that the dissent made, is that this distinction between informed consent requirements and the requirements that California has here, that distinction doesn't really make much of a difference, but that was not accepted by a majority of the court.
Well, thank you, Professor Moreland, for helping us understand, for elucidating some of these finer points in constitutional law. Michael Moreland is a professor of law and religion at Villanova University. It's been great to have you on.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz, and you're listening to Radio Boston.